Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening to WLRN. Today on the program, we feature four questions from four listeners who wanted to know more about two huge influences in South Florida's economy, immigration and real estate. After Henry Flagler's railroad and Napoleon Broward's pledge to drain the Everglades forged the beginnings of today's modern South Florida, no two forces have been as influential on the economy as immigration and real estate. In fact, the two are intertwined with Flagler and Governor Broward. Immigrants provided the labor, while the railroad and draining the Everglades opened up real estate.
Why are house prices so incredibly high in Miami, especially when the median income is so low? It's lower than the national average in the county.
That's Sarah Graff. She's a medical student who was shocked at the price of homes when she moved to Miami with her husband and their young son. We will hear her story later on in the program, but she asked a question a lot of people wonder about. It's simple enough of a question, right? How can housing prices here be so high if incomes aren't enough to support them? Well, we'll talk about what the average price is for a home and what the average salary is. And yes, there's a gap. It's a pretty big gap. But part of the answer also is the continued magnetism of South Florida. Our population keeps growing with new residents, snowbirds, and foreign money coming to spend some time in the sun. It puts a great deal of demand on a housing market that is squeezed between the Everglades and the Atlantic Ocean. And that squeeze also is being felt by renters, like retired special education teacher Margaret Cox, who continues to see her rents increase every year.
I'm just wondering if, you know, there are any limits, because each year my rent seems to go up different amounts each time. So I just wondered if there was any set amount that they could raise it each year.
Each of these two questions deals with the cost of living, what's probably the most expensive part of living in South Florida, real estate. The price influences everything from property tax revenues to local governments and schools to how much is left over to spend on other things in the economy or to save money for a rainy day. The price of buying a home or renting a condo were common questions we received from you. Some of the four questions we tackle on today's program came through our Palm Readers Project. It's our public-powered journalism project where you can submit questions you want our news reporters to explore. You can add your question on our website, wlrn.org/palmreaders. What about the South Florida economy are you curious about? You can tell us online. We also received several questions about immigrants and the economy. Now, the issue of immigration has been big since the presidential race. Every month, the Gallup organization surveys Americans about what they think the most important problem is for the country. Earlier this year, immigration was mentioned as the most important challenge, even bigger than jobs or the economy in general. Think about what was happening back in February and March. President Donald Trump had tried to temporarily stop immigration from seven predominantly Muslim countries. His first executive order was blocked by a federal judge. That decision was upheld on appeal. The president's second executive order was also blocked. Now, two different federal appeals courts hear arguments over the next 2 weeks in cases that led to blocking that second executive order. Just days before President Trump signed the first travel ban order in late January, he signed a separate executive order stopping federal money from going to communities acting as sanctuary cities. While Miami-Dade County never officially declared itself as a sanctuary community, the county commission approved a policy in 2013 that refused to indefinitely hold suspects wanted by immigration agents because the federal government didn't pay the county for its expenses. After President Trump's executive order threatened sanctuary cities, County Mayor Carlos Jimenez was quick to order county jails to comply with federal requests to detain people wanted by immigration authorities instead of risking the elimination of federal funds. And this set off protests. About 3 weeks later, the county commission met to formally vote on Mayor Jimenez's order, and it passed. Commission Chair Steve Bovo spoke to WLRN that day.
First of all, we need to comply with the law, and federal law requires us to hold these individuals for 48 hours, and we should be complying with federal law. You know, I don't think that it should be anything more than that.
More than 150 people addressed the commission that day before it voted. Among them was Martha Singleton, a retired Miami-Dade police captain.
If an undocumented immigrant who is law-abiding and has been a resident perhaps of Miami for years is afraid to go to school or work, do you think they're really going to call the police when they witness a crime, specifically in the Sexual Crimes Bureau?
And that's a division Singleton knows something about. She used to work in the Sexual Crimes Bureau in Miami-Dade before she retired a few years ago. Now, how does this relate to the economy here? Well, it got the retired police officer thinking about the role of immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, in the South Florida economy. And it led her to submitting this question.
I wanted to know if WLRN could tell me what percentage of the community, of the immigrant population made up the community, divided into, if it was possible, the percentage of documented, legal immigrants and residents of Miami and those that are in the shadows, the undocumented, or what some people call the illegal immigrants who live in Miami.
Now, you may be thinking, of course immigrants play a big role in the economy here. Yes, an enormous role throughout the entire region. Trying to get a handle on the role of undocumented immigrants is more difficult, though, due to the nature of being undocumented. But there are hundreds of thousands living and working here, according to Pew Research. We will discuss the data about undocumented immigrants in South Florida and the role immigrants and undocumented workers have on certain industries, including the divisive question of whether undocumented workers take jobs away from citizens. A more specific question about undocumented workers in the economy came from Patty Gertenbach of Fort Lauderdale.
The question was, what will the cost of goods and services be if undocumented immigrants are deported?
Now, her question goes beyond the size of the immigrant and undocumented worker populations and right to the potential economic impact of government policy on immigration. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have been conducting targeted enforcement operations this year, going after what it says are undocumented people with criminal records and other violations ranging from child sex crimes to driving with no driver's license. Dozens were arrested in late April in South Florida, including this raid in Homestead.
He got into a domestic with his wife, his old lady. It was child domestic violence abuse with children.
16 arrests were made in Miami-Dade and Broward counties each during the 4 days of the raids. Hundreds of people have been picked up nationwide since the raids began in January. In a region with millions of workers, a few dozen people detained won't get picked up in any economic statistic. So Patty's question about the impact on prices and services if undocumented immigrants are deported may seem like an artificial premise. But in the heated rhetoric of the debate this community and the nation are having over immigration, and at a time of low unemployment overall, it is worth considering the consequences of any all-or-nothing policy. Still to come, before we tackle Patty's question, just how big is the immigrant and undocumented population here in South Florida?
I saw a lot of prejudice from the community, people like me, that were born here, were born in the United States, and they felt like these people, you know, had committed a crime and should be deported, but they're a part of our community, and they just strive for a better life. That's why I asked the question.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Martha Singleton knows South Florida like few of us do. She's a native daughter of Miami-Dade County and spent 30 years policing the county. She retired 5 years ago as a captain of the Miami-Dade Police Department.
I worked road patrol. I worked burglary investigations. I worked general investigations. I worked in the Sexual Crimes Bureau.
It was her work there that prompted Martha to speak out against the county following requests from immigration agents to detain suspected undocumented immigrants. After the county commission reversed 3 years of policy to end its unofficial sanctuary city status, she sent us this question.
What percentage of the community of the immigrant population made up the community divided into, if it was possible, the percentage of documented, legal immigrants and residents of Miami and those that are in the shadows, the undocumented?
We wanted to know more about why a veteran retired police officer worried about an immigration crackdown discouraging undocumented immigrants from reporting crimes or coming forward as witnesses would ask the question. we didn't hear a story about patrolling the streets of South Florida. Instead, Martha started telling us a story about her mom.
She wanted to stay at home, and she did stay at home until the very end. So we had different caregivers that came in. They were all trained, either home health aides or certified nursing assistants. All of them except for one were from Central or South America. There were three women that were from Colombia, three sisters. They were all very good. They all came here decades ago with their families. They came here legally on temporary visas. They applied for citizenship. They all vote. And but there was one particular, my main full-time that worked Monday through Friday, and that was my rock. She had raised four kids. All of them were born here in the United States, except for one. She came here with one daughter when she was 4 years old, so that daughter was born in Colombia.
And it is that daughter who's the main character in Martha's story. She came to the United States when she was four. Her mom came to the U.S. legally and was a home health care aide for Martha's mom in her final years. When this daughter of the healthcare worker who was not born in the United States turned 18, she was told that she needed to apply to stay in the U.S. now that she was an adult.
She ignored everything, to make a really long story short. She fell in love. She had a beautiful little girl. And when that daughter, but she never applied for citizenship, so she was living in the shadows. So ICE caught up with her. She ignored all her notices to appear. And one day my caregiver arrived at my house in tears to tell me that, you know, her daughter was called her from Crum Detention Center.
Martha says the daughter of her caregiver was deported. Her caregiver's granddaughter, who was born in the U.S., was left in the care of her grandmother.
Basically, my middle-aged, probably mid-40s, hard-working, full-time caregiver that took delicate care of my mom, was a member of the family, also had to raise her granddaughter. Her granddaughter calls her mommy. That was 8 years ago. The little girl just turned 12 on the 1st of May, and she does get to visit with her mother, but her mother's never been able to return.
That's Martha's direct experience with undocumented immigrants, not from her years wearing the badge, but from taking care of her mom. For Martha, it's these personal relationships that help spark her curiosity.
I asked the question because I believe it's a large part of Miami, and I believe that without them, it really drives our economy, and it would really hurt us if they were to disappear overnight.
What we actually have data on is about the Miami metro area, which comprises Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm, so the Tri-County area here in South Florida.
That's Ali Bustamante. He's a professor at FIU and works with the school's Center for Labor Research and Studies.
And what we actually find is that in the Tri-County area, we have a foreign-born population that is 39% of the total population, about 2.4 million foreign-born immigrants here in South Florida.
So that's about two out of every five people from Jupiter to Florida City born in a different country. This includes legal and undocumented immigrants. Pew Research estimates about 450,000 people who live in South Florida are undocumented. That's about 7.5% of the entire South Florida population.
The second part of Martha's question, Ali, really relates to the economic influence that 500,000 undocumented immigrant count in South Florida has on the local economy.
And so certainly. So as you mentioned, you know, when we look at the size of the undocumented immigrant population in South Florida, we're just talking about 7.3 of the total South Florida population in the Miami metro area. So when we think about it in terms of that figure, it's a relatively small figure. But when we consider the impact that undocumented immigrants have in our economy, we have to think not necessarily on their size, but certainly on the role that they play in our community, and particularly how much of a pillar in our community they in our workforce they currently serve. And something to keep in mind is that when we think about undocumented immigrants, the great majority of them, 90% of them, have actually been in South Florida prior to 2010. And so when we think of who undocumented immigrants are, they're not necessarily a source of temporary labor, but they're certainly an entrenched part of our communities.
So these are folks who have been part of the community by almost a decade now.
Absolutely. And that means that, again, not only are they, you know, they might not have necessarily a large size, a large presence in terms of population in South Florida, but they certainly do have, they're certainly ingrained in our communities and are currently playing a pivotal role.
And what accounts for that economic influence that while as a percentage of the population, that undocumented immigrant population in the broader South Florida region is less than 1 in 10, but the economic impact is generally thought of as what?
Yeah, well, immigrants have much higher rates of business ownership. Immigrants have much higher rates of labor participation than native populations. And not only that, but immigrants tend to work in industries where labor shortages are profound. And so this really points to a lot of the research that tells us that immigration as a whole, documented and undocumented, tends to raise productivity, increase economic output, you know, increases innovation and the general dynamism in our economies.
One other part about immigrants and the economic impact we should bring up, especially when it comes to the statistical measurement of an immigrant population, is a number of those immigrants could have become U.S. citizens. They may be foreign-born, but they may have gone through the citizenship process.
Absolutely. And, you know, in terms of the citizenship process, we actually find that once foreign-born immigrants actually do become citizens, their contributions to the local economy and to the state economy actually increases as well, just because it goes hand-in-hand with the greater economic opportunities that immigrants, once they become naturalized citizens, the greater opportunities that they have ultimately translate to greater economic activity, which ultimately enables our economy to be larger and more dynamic than it would otherwise be. When it comes to the broader American context, there was a very interesting study released by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine related to immigration in the U.S., which largely found that between 1990 and 2010, both legal and unauthorized immigration actually produced net benefits worth over $50 billion a year to the native population. And so it's not necessarily about, it's not necessarily a one-sided story when it comes to the gains that immigrants actually post in our communities. Certainly, they benefit from greater economic opportunities, but so do native populations.
So to try to have some pushback to the criticism that an undocumented population is going to avail itself of social services and thus be a net cost to the economy.
Exactly right. So instead, we actually see a tremendous great net benefit. And again, and much of that largely comes from the fact that immigrant populations tend to raise productivity. They tend to have great rates of entrepreneurship and labor participation, which ultimately allow our economy to be larger and more dynamic than it would otherwise be.
Ali Bustamante with FIU's Center for Labor Research and Studies. Today on the program, we're featuring four questions submitted to us from listeners. Two questions about real estate, two about immigration and the economy. If you have a question you'd like us to consider, check out our new public-powered journalism project, Palm Readers. You can submit that question at wlrn.org/palmreaders. Still to come, with undocumented immigrants making up about 7.5% of the population in South Florida, what would happen to prices that we pay for everything from food to housing if they weren't working in the economy?
Our economy, we've become dependent on artificially low prices. And I thought about, advertising. Most advertising isn't about quality. It's about low prices.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Today, we're answering questions we received from four listeners about the South Florida economy. The questions were about two enormous issues for the economy that touch every household and every business one way or another, the housing market and immigration. These are complex issues. Public policies around these issues affect our community in countless ways. The economy is just one. How challenges in these areas are addressed have implications on everything from companies adding jobs and finding workers to fill them to consumer spending and the price of life in the Sunshine Economy. Patty Gertenbach is a geologist for an environmental engineering and consulting group. She lives in Fort Lauderdale and says she's been collecting rocks since elementary school.
If you pick up any book about anything that's a nonfiction, the first thing they're going to tell you about is the geology of the place. So the geology of Florida. I'm going to Hawaii in a few weeks. The geology of Hawaii. And geology shapes our environment in one of those things. It's like behind the scenes. People don't even realize it. For example, with the limestone in South Florida, nobody really realizes that you can't really equate South Florida and sea level rise with like what's happening in Europe in the Dutch world where they can build walls. We can't build walls to keep the sea rising out. So that's one thing that affects us here. It affects the where we plant plants, where we plant our vegetables. It has to have good soil. I could go on and on.
Yeah, the parallels between how Patty sees geology and her question to us about undocumented immigration in the economy were not lost on her. She sees geology as a behind-the-scenes science that is fundamental to understanding other issues. Much the same could be said for immigration and the debated influence of undocumented immigration on the economy. Supporters of cracking down on undocumented people say they use social services paid for by legal residents and citizens, and they argue undocumented workers fill jobs at lower wages that Americans then cannot compete with.
I first heard about people complaining about illegal immigrants taking construction jobs in the 1970s. At the time, I lived in Los Angeles. And I thought in the 1970s, so we're talking 40 years ago, why doesn't the government crack down on employers? They never did. And now, you know, it's like embedded in our economy.
There have been instances of immigration raids at companies catching undocumented workers, such as a textile plant raid in New Bedford, Massachusetts back in 2007. A year later, ICE agents raided an Iowa meatpacking plant. A former CEO was arrested in that case. He remains in a federal prison today, convicted not of breaking immigration laws, but of fraud and money laundering as a result of an investigation into the company's finances after the raid at his plant. His business wound up declaring bankruptcy. For Patty, the geologist, the question of undocumented immigration in the economy here in South Florida is one she believes has not been addressed head on.
I don't think that people really understand that how this could affect our day-to-day economy. Like, it could affect everybody. Our food, construction, you know, the price of houses, lawn maintenance, going to restaurants. The question was, what will the cost of goods and services be if undocumented immigrants are deported?
You know, that's actually an excellent question, and one that I think has not necessarily received a lot of attention, either from most news outlets, and certainly not from policymakers.
Again, Ali Bustamante is with FIU's Center for Labor Research and Studies.
You know, when we think about mass deportation, the fact that, you know, a large swath of our population will automatically be gone from one day to the next, or at least within a given time period, we're talking about the cost and availability of many goods and services being impacted. And this particularly would be evident in industries that employ large shares of undocumented immigrants. Many of these industries will automatically face labor shortages that will ultimately compel them to do one of two things: either go out of business because they don't necessarily have the labor force to provide the goods and services that they had in the past, or the level of service that they had in the past, or secondly, their second option would be to raise prices due to increased labor costs. You know, and what's particularly impactful in terms of the South Florida community is the industries where this is likely to happen are childcare, construction, food service, and to a lesser extent, agriculture. And these are just a few of the industries.
How difficult is it to try to capture this labor cost of undocumented labor in those service industries that they tend to work in, because of a cash economy or kind of the gray economy?
Yeah, that's extremely difficult in terms of getting a hard dollar figure, because, you know, many of these workers aren't necessarily on the books or aren't necessarily actively being accounted for. But what we do know is that in Florida as a whole, undocumented labor, undocumented immigrants represent 6.2% of the entire labor force. And that's probably at a much higher rate here in South Florida. Unfortunately, we don't have the figures for South Florida. However, we do know that It's the equivalent of automatically removing hundreds of thousands of workers from the workforce here in South Florida, and we can certainly see, particularly in the fact that this population is heavily concentrated in a handful of industries.
Now, when we do look at wages in Florida, we do see very little change over the past decade when it comes to the average wage that a Floridian is able to get in the marketplace. Is that driven at all by the influence of a 6% workforce from undocumented immigrants?
So it's not necessarily that, undocumented labor is depressing wages because, you know, many employers are employing, cheap undocumented labor at the expense of more expensive native populations. That's certainly not happened. These things are native populations and undocumented labor are not substitute, but they're largely more complementary in their relationship.
Why aren't they substitute? Why isn't an undocumented worker a substitute for a domestic worker, as the case may be?
The main reason is actually a quite obvious one. The cultural and language barriers or the cultural and language differences between native populations and undocumented immigrants. And particularly this is looking at the fact that the industries that, when we look at the industries where undocumented immigrants are largely concentrated in, again, these are industries that historically have labor shortages, and that even with undocumented labor, that there are documented labor shortages in these industries, particularly something like construction. It's an awfully cyclical industry. However, when absent a recession, construction has pervasive labor shortages that are largely go unfulfilled. This is why many businesses ultimately turn to undocumented immigrants. And even in construction alone, we see a very large divide between the jobs that undocumented immigrants do versus those of native populations. It's their ability to fulfill these positions that enables native populations to actually have more job opportunities, particularly up in higher rungs of the economic ladder.
So how embedded is cheap labor into service prices that South Floridians see in the marketplace in the industries where undocumented workers tend to gather?
I think it's pivotal, and I think it's a crucial determinant of the prices that we currently pay, whether you're looking at housing, childcare, or food. Much of these industries are industries that have that are largely structured to use a high share of labor as opposed to more automated. Automated or capital intensive kind of resources. We're looking at something like childcare. You know, the great cost for most childcare providers, whether they're center based or not, is labor. The fact that it's expensive, despite the fact that most childcare centers or most childcare providers are using discounted labor, it really kind of provides us with a strong indication of how much more prices can be if these kind of labor costs were to increase substantially across the board for an industry like childcare.
The debate over the fate of undocumented immigrants and the impact in the economy has really been a blunt edge between they're taking jobs from Americans and they are consuming social services without paying the full tax liability, the full tax basis that documented workers and native workers tend to pay. What are the nuances that are missed in that blunt force debate?
Much of the research has certainly largely pointed to the fact that undocumented labor and native or documented immigrant labor, that they're largely complementary. Again, they largely reinforce another and enable our community to grow at a much larger to expand at a much larger clip than would otherwise be the case without undocumented labor.
Ali Bustamante with FIU's Center for Labor Research and Studies. He was answering a listener question from Patty Gertenbach. She was asking about what the impact would be on prices if undocumented workers were deported and disappeared from the economy. Now, Patty was prepared for part of the answer to be higher costs.
You know, so going out to a restaurant's going to be higher. Hotel, these are things where I think there are undocumented immigrants that are working are in a lot of the service industry. So a lot of the service industries are going to go up, but certainly the price of food is going to go up.
Geologist Patty Gertenbach from Fort Lauderdale submitted her question to WLRN. You can too by visiting WLRN.org/palm-readers. Still to come, we turn our attention to real estate, the high price of housing, and the sticker shock new residents can experience.
We recently moved to Miami a year ago, and we were trying to find some affordable housing for our family, and it was nearly impossible. It was impossible to find that. We wound up finding an apartment.
This is now a central issue of regional economic competitiveness.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Great journalism begins with a question. We've been asking you to submit questions to us about all kinds of things, including the South Florida economy. Several of the first questions we received were related to real estate.
We're recording.
This is Margaret Cox.
I live in Miami. Do you want my full address or just where I live?
Margaret is a retired special education public school teacher. She lives with her 92-year-old mother in a two-bedroom apartment. Margaret wanted to know about raising the rent and if there are any limits as to how much landlords can raise a tenant's monthly rent.
No, I'm just wondering if, you know, there are any limits, because I've been renting forever. I tried to buy a condo and it all fell through. And I've been renting for a long time. And, you know, each year my rent seems to go up different amounts each time. So I just wondered if there was any set amount that they could raise it each year.
Sarah Graff, Miami, Florida.
While Margaret may be at the end of her career, Sarah is at the beginning of hers. She is a medical student, a wife, and a mother to a four-year-old. She's also curious about real estate, but instead of renting, Sarah wanted to know about the price to buy a home.
Why are house prices so incredibly high in Miami, especially when the median income is so low? It's lower than the national average in the county.
And Sarah has her data correct. The median income in South Florida is about $50,000, actually below that in Miami-Dade County. It's $3,000 below the national average region-wide. The average single-family home here is just about $300,000, more than $100,000 over the national average. And the median rent for a two-bedroom apartment here, over $300 more per month versus the national median rent. So yes, housing is more expensive on average in South Florida compared to the rest of the country, whether it is to buy or to rent, and incomes are less. Housing affordability is a huge issue locally. And for Margaret Cox, the retired teacher, and Sarah Graff, the medical student, mom, and wife, it's a quality of life issue that they are very conscious of how it affects their household budgets. And that helps explain why the price of housing, buying or renting, was a common theme among several of the questions submitted through our Palm Readers project. So let's start with Sarah's situation. I spoke with her via Skype, interrupting her studying for a medical licensing exam.
We recently moved to Miami a year ago, and we were trying to find some affordable housing for our family. We have a young son, and we were looking for, you know, just a suburbia house with a backyard, nothing too big, nothing opulent, just a run-of-the-mill place to stay. And it was nearly impossible. It was impossible to find that. We wound up finding an apartment.
Sarah and her family moved to Miami from Grenada, but she was familiar with American housing prices. Her husband is from Wisconsin and she's from Southern California.
We were blown away. Absolute sticker shock.
She says she's never seen housing prices like they encountered in South Florida as they went about looking for a place to live.
We set a budget, and that budget got us nowhere.
They were disciplined. They set a limit of no more than a third of their income to pay for a home. And that's what financial experts say is a good rule of thumb. About 30 cents of every dollar to go for housing. That's it.
We increased the budget, and that started to interfere with our quality of life. We would have to start reallocating funds from whether it be travel or even entertainment, childcare, etc., to the rent. And it got to a point where we were not willing to sacrifice our quality of life for a house.
So instead of renting a single-family home, she, her husband, and their 4-year-old son lived together in an apartment.
A lot of people who moved here thinking it was going to be a bargain, I think, genuinely surprised.
Kevin Greiner is a senior fellow at FIU's Metropolitan Center, where he studies housing affordability issues.
They're also surprised what may look on a listing as a reasonable price. They find out the unit is a whole lot smaller than they thought it was. So that I'm not surprised by sticker shock at all, really.
Sticker shock is common for most working people looking at South Florida real estate, whether they're first-time buyers or veterans of South Florida's boom and bust and boom housing market. Even though the national economy has slowed, foreign interest in South Florida has waned, and the U.S. dollar remains strong against international currencies, housing prices posted gains in March compared to a year earlier. The average price for a single-family home in Broward was up by more than 10% in March, almost 9% up in Palm Beach County. In Miami-Dade County, single-family home prices jumped by 15% compared to a year earlier.
Miami's unique in North America. Only two other cities, L.A. and New York, have the same international profile. So that Miami is still a really desirable place to live.
Since 2010, more than 400,000 people have moved to South Florida, from Palm Beach County all the way down to Key West. Most of them came to Miami-Dade and Broward counties. Two out of every five people who moved to the entire state of Florida since the beginning of the decade have moved to the four counties making up our region in South Florida. That kind of growth has far exceeded the new supply of housing units. So the demand for housing is a big reason for higher real estate prices.
What's been happening, because Miami's market is so successful, the number of units kind of at the middle and lower levels of cost and affordability, that's where the real shortage of new units have been. And a lot of those units, of course, with rising prices, are now moving out of that reach for middle-income families.
So let's talk about prices. The average home in Miami-Dade County, single-family home, costs $322,000. In Broward, it's $331,000. In Palm Beach County, over $325,000. Now, these prices would take a household income of at least $70,000 per year to comfortably afford. The average in South Florida is closer to $50,000. And that's the affordability challenge behind Sarah Graff's question to us. It's a challenge that Sarah says may keep her from staying and being a doctor here.
I wanted to apply for residency out here. However, the number one barrier for me to become a doctor here in South Florida is the cost of housing.
Recognize that this is now a central issue of regional economic competitiveness.
Again, Kevin Greiner with FIU's Metropolitan Center.
If we can't figure this out, coming from both ends, then Miami-Dade's looking at a future where you can't retain your young talent. Once that starts, it's a spiral that's really hard to recover from.
Is this a challenge that is shared by Broward and Palm Beach counties as well?
It is, absolutely. In fact, Broward is quickly moving up on Miami-Dade in terms of total unaffordability.
As for Sarah, she, her husband, and their 4-year-old son, they will soon be moving out of their rental apartment and into a single-family home. Now, it's still a rental, but it's affordable, meaning it's about a third of their income.
We have actually just leased another home in Kendall. So we're moving out of our current apartment into a home. And everything was based around his schooling and not breaking that one-third rule, which we broke a little bit, but nothing too extreme.
I'd say that Sarah's and her family is still doing extremely well by Miami standards.
The financial ideal is to spend 30% of your income on monthly mortgage payments or rent. Anything over that, and you are considered what's called cost burdened by housing. So by that measure, 30% of income, one in five homeowners in Miami-Dade County are considered cost burdened. But it's even worse for renters, with one out of every three. Kevin Greiner again with FIU's Metropolitan Center.
That's the biggest issue here in Miami-Dade, is that the number of cost-burdened households, those paying 30% or more on their rent, is more than double the national average. It's way ahead of the rest of the country. In fact, right now, in terms of the absolute number of households, the 850,000 or so households in Miami-Dade County, 49 and moving quickly to 50% of them are cost burdened.
Put another way, one out of every two households in Miami-Dade is spending more than 30% of its income on housing alone. That's for homeowners paying mortgages and for renters. So still to come, a different question about real estate, but still focused on the high price to live here.
I've been renting for a long time, and you know, each year my rent seems to go up different amounts each time.
The overriding issue for most property owners is, what can I get? What is the market bearing? And the issue for South Florida is the supply of rental housing is not keeping up with the demand.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. We've been answering listener questions about the South Florida economy on today's program. The four questions we're featuring hit upon two massive financial issues, immigration and real estate. Both have forged today's modern global economy here. It's an evolution Margaret Cox has witnessed firsthand. She retired a couple of years ago after being a special education public school teacher. She turns 68 years old this month and has rented for a long time, renting in the same large apartment complex for about 20 years.
My first apartment, I had two bedrooms and 1.5 bathrooms, and I paid
$800. $800 a month. That was back in 1997. Now, adjusted for inflation, that's about $1,200 today. But the average rent on a two-bedroom apartment in Miami-Dade County has been moving up faster than overall inflation. According to Zillow, the average two-bedroom apartment now rents for over $1,700 per month. In Broward and Palm Beach counties, the average is about $1,500. In the Keys, a two-bedroom rents for twice that, close to $3,000, by far the most expensive in the region.
In the apartment that I'm currently in, I started paying, like $1,300, and it's close to $1,600 now in 4 years. I have a two-bedroom, two-bathroom apartment, and it's kind of nice. I've been here for a long time, so I'm pretty sure that I'm paying, you know, a fairly good rate. I live in a pretty nice neighborhood. It's not, you know, run down or anything like that. But it's not a top model apartment, you know.
Now, Margaret wanted to know if there's any limit at all on how much landlords in Florida can raise the monthly rent.
Each year, my rent seems to go up different amounts each time. So I just wondered if there was any set amount that they could raise it each year.
Margaret is on a fixed income as she's retired. She cares for her 92-year-old mother. She also pays for a reserved parking spot so she can park close to her apartment with her mom. That's another $45 per month that she has to pay for.
I don't do any of the fun things I used to do. I used to subscribe to the theater. I used to go, you know, all of those kinds of things have had to stop. I don't go out occasionally. I may have a meal out with my friends, but all my entertainment kind of things have had to stop. And I contribute a great deal less now to charity than I used to. And so that's how I'm managing to keep up. You know, I just have to take away things so that I can continue to pay my rent.
A lot of personal spending can fall victim to high housing costs, especially for senior citizens on fixed incomes who are renting. Like Margaret Cox, they face the possibility of annual rent increases outpacing any increases in their Social Security, pension, or retirement incomes. And in Dade County, the second fastest growing population since the beginning of the decade is among those 65 to 69 years old, the traditional beginning of retirement. It's the fastest growing age group in Broward and Palm Beach counties. So back to Margaret's simple question.
Each year, my rent seems to go up different amounts each time. So I just wondered if there was any set amount that they could raise it each year.
The very simple and clear answer to that question is no.
That's Jim Karras. He runs his company called Karras Community Investment. He also lectures on housing and affordable housing at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We spoke with him via Skype from his office in Fort Lauderdale.
There are no restrictions whatsoever, either through the state or any of the counties or any of the municipalities.
So in other words, there is no rent control in the Sunshine State. He says if there's a lease, that will spell out the rental amount and how long that will be the charge.
But once that lease is up, the landlord or the property owner has the right to raise it as much as he or she feels that is appropriate.
And that depends upon the market forces of supply and demand. And it's driven by a landlord's cost to own and keep up the property. A big component of that is the property tax bill on an apartment building. And those buildings do not enjoy limits on how much property taxes can go up like residential properties do in Florida.
Commercial property is taxed, it can increase without any ceiling to it. Homesteaded properties, we have Save Our Homes, so there's a limit in terms of how much can increase on property taxes. On commercial property owners, property taxes can increase to the market rate.
There are a couple of ways annual increases in property taxes are limited for homeowners who are living in their properties. A constitutional amendment approved by voters in 1995 limits annual property tax increases on homes to 3% if they have a homestead exemption. And a homestead exemption itself helps take out a slice of the taxable value of a home. Rental properties do not enjoy such protections, so when it comes to figuring out how much to charge in rent, landlords look at their expenses for the cost of ownership. The market rate then is exactly what you think it is, whatever someone is willing to pay.
The overriding issue for most property owners is, what can I get? What is the market bearing? And the issue for South Florida is the supply of rental housing is not keeping up with the demand.
Supply and demand, economics 101. While there has been new buildings built since the housing collapse, many of those are condominiums, for sale product in the language of real estate. It's only recently more for rent buildings have been coming into the market, but the demand remains heavy. Consider this. Compared to 2010, there are 25,000 fewer homeowners in Miami-Dade County, but 75,000 more renters. So the demand for rental units continues to increase. And no, Margaret, there is no rent control in Florida.
There are no controls. I thought so. I pretty much thought so, yeah. I know in Canada there were when I lived in New York City. There were rent-controlled apartments, you know. when I came down here, but when I first came here to Florida, the rents were like really minimal compared to New York City, you know, I would say they now probably match. They pretty much match the city.
Of course, that all depends upon location. On average, New York rents remain above those in Miami. Jim Karas with Karas Community Investment, who's been studying housing affordability for more than 25 years, does not think South Florida, despite its housing affordability struggles right now, is about to turn to rent controls.
In my experience, rent control is almost never on the table of discussion in South Florida. The political will to incorporate rent control in South Florida, it does not exist. It's barely mentioned. And why that is that I think there is a negative perception of the potential negative impact that rent control has on development.
If apartment building developers and owners are limited in the rents they can charge, the argument is maybe they won't answer the demand with new supply. Some of the questions for today's program came through our Palm Readers Project. You can find out more on our website, WLRN.org. Pilar Uribe is our technical director, Katie Lepre, our engagement producer. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks as always for listening.